Les colloques du Collège de France.
Yeah, thank you so much for all of you for being here. I'm really excited, and thanks obviously Jean-Jacques for the very kind invitation indeed. So it gives me the opportunity to in fact speak about stuff that I normally don't cover much, not related immediately to horses, even though you will see at some point some horses. And the stuff is about the work we've been doing over the years at the Center for Anthropobiology and Genomics of Toulouse, where we try to measure time in the past. And by that, I mean the age at death of people who were living in the past. When did they end up their life in the past? And so the very nature of the archaeological remains limits somehow what we can tell about the past, you will admit, right? Because most of the time, we don't have the nice movies to show that we have seen today of people alive when they were alive. We only have dead corpses, really. And most of the time, they are very fragmentary, indeed, like parts of skulls or parts of teeth or some postcranial elements. And that, of course, limits the kind of information that you can gain about the past and about those complex societies. But over the last, say, two decades or so, there's a bunch of emerging technologies that help us uncover features that are probably unexpected about the past. And the technologies that we know the most of at the CAGT Center is really are related to DNA, when it preserves in archaeological remains, ancient DNA. And it preserves only when there are good conditions of preservation, such as when it's not too old, with the time record of the oldest DNA as of now being about 2 million years, and when it's not too warm, so relatively cold or mild environments. And of course, when you have ancient DNA molecules and whole genome sequences, in fact, about old or ancient individuals, you can learn much about the past. For example, if I take some people who are living in the UK during the Neolithic period, here you realize that they are genetically intermediate between the local hunter-gatherers that were existing in the UK before them in the Mesolithic and those Anatolian farmers who invented agriculture. In other words, they are formed by the merger of two population backgrounds. So you see actually in dead corpses through the DNA lens, you see migration back in time. Another thing that we learn about the past individuals when we have ancient DNA is really phenotypes that we would not be able to measure should we not have the DNA. If you only have bones and teeth, it's hard to predict the color of the eyes of the people or the color of their skin. And yet, because we know so much about the genotype-phenotype relationship for such traits, we can, given genotypes, predict the most likely phenotypes that they had. Another thing that we can learn is actually about kinship structures in the past. And for example, in that very example, these are people who were buried about 5,000 years ago, somewhere around what we call today Poland. We can learn that the person or the persons who have buried the victims of this mass murderer actually knew the people so well that they were disposed by family groups. Family here being people that are biologically related to the first or second degree. In other words, what we call nuclear families, in fact. So lots we can learn that is probably unexpected. But of course, there is lots of things that remain pending in what we can tell about the past individuals. And one of those things is the very topic of this conference, which is about time and when did those people die in the past. In other words, when you see such remains, when he or she ended up their life, is it when they were 22, 28, 60, 40? And of course, knowing this answer for that very person, or in fact, better for the whole population, will give a lot of information about the demographic prospects of that population. It will tell you something about life expectancy in the past, and probably the dynamics of age classes to be replaced by the next age class. So fairly important questions, which is why lots of people have drawn their attention to try to find some kind of markers about helping people to predict the age of death of people. So the good news is that there is tons of methodologies that are available that kind of work. And here I'm just illustrating one that is based on the morphology of the whole teeth rolls, and where people have used full panoramic views of people of known age, and then AI clustering to sort of predict the age of every single person. And when they do that, assuming that people are between 7 to 23 years old, actually they reach precision of about half a year to a year and a half. So should you be given the whole tooth row and those kind of panels to scale the AI-based model, you will be able to achieve precision. But for people between 7 to 23 years old, and in fact, if you apply this methodology and others to older people, say adults, it becomes a lot more problematic. So what people have done here, and of course there are tons of markers, I can't cover them all, is that they have used the shape of the pelvis as well as the presence of some particular discrete characters on the pelvis, and used some people that they knew the age of, a whole cohort of people, of dead people living to who lived in this particular generation, and try to use the presence, absence of those characters, including the shape of the pelvis, to try to estimate the age. And as you can immediately see, should you do that in males or females, if you have someone that is, say, 50 years old, what you end up predicting is something between, you know, 18 to probably 70 years old. So in other words, precisions that are absolutely non-existing. Meaning that those technologies, in fact, will tell you nothing more than what you will see with your own eyes, probably that the person was an adult. And this is not good enough to obviously fit the objective of inferring the whole age classes of the past. So this is why people have shifted at some point from morphological characters into and go into more sort of molecular, if not atomic, or others markers. And here I'm showing an example of what some people have proposed, which is using or leveraging the rate of amino acid racemization and especially of the aspartate. And this is because this is the fastest racemization rate of our amino acids. And if you look at the biological amino acids, they come in L form. And so if you take the presence of the aspartate in L form versus the D form, the isomeric form that is non-biological, it tells you something about the time it took for that tissue to transform the L form into the D form. So if you take a tissue that has no metabolic turnover, for example, you take dentin, for example, the L amino acid for the aspartate that you have comes with the emergence of your tooth, and it will not change or will not be renewed throughout your age. That means that you can measure the ratio of D over L aspartate amino acids, and it will somehow predict something related to the age of the people. The problem, it works really well with age precision of about a couple of years, but the problem with that is that it's time dependent, sure, but it's temperature dependent. In other words, if you die in a warm environment, you will be predicted the age of a centenarian as opposed to the real age of the person. And there is also another big problem when you work with really old material or individuals is that dentin or any kind of biological tissue is not a closed environment. So any contamination that enters into the system will actually shift the ratio of L over D aspartate, shifting the age prediction of the individual. So really for what I'm interested in, we can't really use that, even though they use that in forensic cases as I'm speaking. There used to be big hopes in some of the stuff that Eric has covered for us today, try to leverage the length of telomeres, really, to try to predict the age of the individuals, with the rationale that telomeres' length becomes shorter as with increasing numbers of cell divisions, so somehow it's a clock measurement. But here again, you realize that this sort of x-axis is proportional to the length, so there is indeed the expected decrease, is inversely proportional to the length, so there's a negative relationship. But you see that here again, the precision is in the range of like plus minus 20 years. So it doesn't fit the job, really. There is another reason why we wouldn't use that with ancient DNA is that this is the length of DNA. And as you die, the length shortens by the DNA decay processes that happens post-mortem because they don't repair their DNA being dead, right? So length is not a good proxy. And so this is where we we're interested ourselves, our lab, to leverage other kind of proxies. And this is where the methodologies presented by Eric came into play, where people have realized that if you take some CpGs along the genome, so here this is individual on the x-axis, and CpG denucleotides along the genome, some of them will be methylated differently according to the age of the sample. So for example, it will become, I think, brighter, the color, when the frequency of methylation at that site increases. You realize that there are some sites where probably you have pale colors in a small age and like increasingly dark colors as the people age, basically. So that means that there are some CpG sites, denucleotides in the genome, whose frequency of methylation globally in a pool of cells is age-dependent. So if you actually cluster all those CpG or clock CpGs, as they are called, together, you could actually derive a sort of mathematical prediction that relates the age with the distribution of methylation values that you have with fairly good precision, below 3 or 4 years typically, or even less these days, right? And so the way it works is that imagine that you have a panel of individuals, some old, some like younger, different ages. The methodology tries to find an additive model in which the methylation level that I show in different shades of gray here, the CpG1 is the methylation level of that CpG along the genome. So the methylation of those CpG sites is actually additively contributing to the age of an individual. So what you need to build such model is a cohort of people of known age, us in this room, measuring the DNA methylation levels at those CpG clocks and use, for example, as they did, elastic net regression to learn the beta factors that contribute the weight of this correlation, basically. So assuming you have the beta factors and DNA methylation levels, you can derive a fairly precise age estimate of an individual. As I said, if I do that in living people today, typically within plus minus 2 years. So far better than any of the stuff that I've shown before. There is more to that, and this is good news, is that, as you know, DNA methylation is tissue specific, but at the end of the day, you could use a cohort of CpGs, clock CpGs along the genome, that do probably very well in a cohort of tissues. So each and every graph show the sort of correlation with age of those clocks in different tissue contexts, and you see that they are fairly well correlated indeed with 0.88 to 0.96 level of correlation, and by and large with a relative error of about 1.2 to 4.9% of the overall lifespan of the people, meaning typically a few years, as I was saying, right? So the good news is that those clocks, despite DNA methylation to be tissue specific, can be derived in a pan tissue manner. And that's really important to us because we don't choose which tissues are preserved. We have teeth, we have bones, and that's probably it, right? So we can't get blood from the past. There is even a better news here, is that we could derive some cohorts of CpG clock CpGs that will actually, and the clock, that will be working not just in us, anatomically modern humans, but actually across the mammals as a whole. So sort of universal clocks. As you can see here, each graph represents the correlation of the human clock versus a non-human species, basically. And you see that they work pretty well hand in hand. So we have not only a pen tissue, but it seems to be a universal clock, which is interesting because people interested in Neanderthals or anatomically modern humans or anything, including horses, may be able to use this technology. So it brings me to DNA methylation. That's the thing that I'm missing right now. We have the beta factors. They come from those studies that I just presented, and they apply universally, it seems. So we need to find a way to measure DNA methylation in the past. And those of you who have done DNA methylation, even with modern DNA, typically what you do is that you destroy your DNA using bisulfite treatment. And the problem is that to do that, you need to have tons of DNA and fairly good, very well-preserved DNA, which we don't have. So that means that we had to invent a trick to be able to derive some DNA methylation estimates in the past. And so this is the trick we have developed more than a decade ago, actually. So this is my DNA when I die, and there will be some hotspots of CpGs with high methylation levels. It's shown in green, I think, CPG here. And there are some cold spots of DNA methylation. So those CPGs, they are not methylated, okay? So they are not green here. When I die, what happens is that my DNA is going to be degraded quite fast. And the faster DNA decay process that happens is actually Cs become deaminated. But if you're a C that is methylated, you are chemically deaminated in what we call T, thymine, creating a swap from a CPG that was methylated into a TPG. But if these were not methylated, it's deaminated into a UPG, which creates a sort of differential pattern between those sites that were methylated and those that were not methylated. Typically, the reverse methylation pattern that we see compared to bisulfite treatment, in fact. We don't bisulfite treat, it's nature degrading the DNA in a way that is inversely related to bisulfite treatment. So if we have that, our idea was let's use some enzymes that will destroy our DNA, not as much as bisulfite treatment, but actually cleaving the UPGs specifically. And so if you cleave the UPGs specifically, what you end up with a pool of sequencing is pretty much enriched in those CPGs that were methylated and transformed into TPGs. So if you sequence that, you could actually derive a methylation score, which will be the density of TPGs that you sequence in locations that were in the reference genome CPGs, and those places where you don't have that are the cold spots that you cleave with enzymatic treatment. So a fairly straightforward approach. Of course, that was the idea originally, but when it comes to the very methodology, it became a lot more tedious, so I don't want to get into the details, but what we ended up modeling is a two-step likelihood-based approach to actually derive those methylation scores. So I will give you an intuition as to why we had to do it that way. The first step is actually assuming a global DNA methylation level across all the CPGs across the cells, which is actually the case when you measure DNA methylation globally. We can actually learn from patterns of TPGs versus CPGs in the genome, what I just explained before, we can learn DNA decay parameters in a position-specific manner. And this is very important because this DNA decay that I mentioned is not uniform across the DNA molecule. It's actually a function of the position of the CPG along the molecule. So it has to be position specific. We do that by maximum likelihood. So we derive now those DNA decay parameters that we learn from the data. And so if we have that, we just apply the scores that we mentioned just before. But this time we will derive local F DNA methylation level at each CPG or region. But we have to correct for the possible presence of genotypes. There are some CPGs that are TPGs in me and CPGs in you, right? So we don't want to get confused by natural polymorphisms in the populations. Neither do we want to be confused by sequencing errors. So the second step is really to avoid the confounding factors contributing to CPG to TPG conversions at the sequence level. So this is where I turn to my favorite species, because the problem that we have is that we derive something that seems to theoretically work really well, but how can we ground proof that? Because I just started by telling you that in humans, we don't know the age of the people in the past. The ideal setup will be to have a cohort of people from the past of known age. We will infer the age using our methodology, and we will sort of measure the level of correlation between those two proxies, basically, which we can't do in humans. But the good thing about horses, there are many things about horses that we like, but the good thing is that you can use their teeth to actually have morphological estimates of their age at the year level. So that's why we switched to horses. And given the morphology of the teeth, you will say that one is 13 years old, that one is 10 years old, and so on and so forth, okay? So I have to just apply this principle, which is fairly simple. So we have a bunch of ancient DNA data from horses of known age. And at the end of the day, we will do the age at death prediction using this sort of methylation beta factors that I mentioned, and the DNA methylation levels as measured in the past. So I have to prove that my DNA methylation levels are correct, which we did by comparing The correlation levels of the DNA methylation predicted measured in the ancient tissues versus those in the modern tissues, tissues alive, basically. And so what you see here in the different colors is the DNA methylation levels that we predict at a single nucleotide level, one CpG, or with an increasing size windows, including more and more CpGs, from one single nucleotide resolution to dark blue, which will be genomic windows, including 50 CpGs, okay? We moved from local, very local resolution to sort of regional resolution. And when we do that, that's for very good reasons, that you realize that single nucleotide resolution we don't have, because the correlation between what we predict in the past and what we measure in living tissues is not so great, 40% or so. But when we pool in regions of at least of as much as 25, I would say, to 50 nucleotides, denucleotide CpGs, we reach DNA methylation correlation of about 69.69, which is encouraging, but far from being good enough at that stage, because as you can realize, the distribution of DNA methylation values in living cells is typically shown here, and the one that we infer in the past doesn't overlay really much, right? In other words, we had to make this a bit more complex. And we had to inject a sort of intermediate step that was not anticipated, which aims at correcting our DNA methylation values. Those that we derive from the likelihood models are not good enough. So we apply a sort of transformation, mathematical transformation, which is, in our case, based on random forest regression. And so, long story short, this is the level of correlation that we reach out to when we do these mathematical transformation of our data. We manage to find really high correlation levels between those CpGs as measured in living tissues and those as measured in ancient tissues, which we were very satisfied about, and especially we managed to correct the lack of intermediate frequencies that we had in the previous group. So how does it work now that we have DNA methylation values and beta factors? We just try. So what you have here is the age as measured from the morphological shifts of the teeth, so the real age, and the one that we predict. And you see that the correlation is fairly high, actually, regardless of the clock that we do use is like two different clocks here, the two colors. And there is a sort of mean average error of about a bit less than 2 years. We could also bootstrap estimate the precision that we have in the value we give, and this is typically in the range of half a year to a year on average. So at that stage, we were thrilled, actually, because we moved from things where we can't tell anything about the age of anything to something that has about a couple of years precision, which in the case of the horse is not as good as morphology, but if it was applied to humans, then I guess we'll have large potential. But that's actually, if I leave it here, I'm actually not giving justice to the reality, in fact. And this is what I will illustrate with simulations here, where we simulate DNA methylation values across the genome, and we use the sequence data and our methodology to estimate the DNA methylation values. And we do that for increasing windows of more and more numbers of CpGs. As you see here, it's 50, the number that I just used before. So X is the coverage in the sequence data. You realize that to get precision, which will be zero here, which is the difference between the inferred and the real simulated value, to get precision, well, you have to have a lot of coverage, which we typically don't have in ancient DNA because we have only the molecules that we have, which was really a bummer. So what we did as a proof of concept was to develop a molecular method, this time not just mathematical, but molecular methods that will say, how about trying to artificially increase the coverage at those positions, those clock CpGs that I mentioned? And so we decided to do that with target enrichment approaches. So this is, nucleotide oligomers, if you will, RNA or DNA, in fact, that actually focus on specific CpGs along the genome. We decide to fish out through those probes from DNA libraries any possible allele, either the TPG or the CpG, so we could fish out from the library whatever molecules are present at those positions. And when we have fished out those molecules from the DNA libraries, we place that on the sequencing machine to achieve a higher local coverage. So how does it work? It really does work. In that proof of principle experiment, we only use 2,000 CpGs. And we retrieve the correlation level that is about the same as the one that used 30,000 position across the genome. So we think that we could improve this even further by targeting not 2,000 clock CpGs, but actually 20,000 or as many as we could, because we retrieve enough enrichment for what we aim doing. So what I've told you about today before I finish is that I believe that we can derive some reliable ancient DNA methylation estimates, assuming that you have high depth of coverage variation, because it's confounded by the DNA decay processes otherwise. And I would advise people to use DNA capture or target enrichment, as I just called it, to reduce the experimental cost and increase precision to levels that will be enough to derive chronological ages. But there is also more to our data. So there are archaeological sites, as the one that you see here to the left, which is a sort of Celtic site from central France, actually, where we measured the age of different horses in the past. So the black will be the inference, the one based on DNA methylation, and the blue will be the tooth-based kind of estimate. You see some sites where there is a fairly good correlation at the site level, but you see sites where correlations really doesn't exist, which we think is a sign that depending on the exposome of ancient individual, their experience over their life, some will age faster than others. So in other words, maybe we don't have just a chronological clock, the one that ticks at the same rate in all people biologically, but in fact, maybe our clock is more biological and reflects somehow how faster some of us age or how slower some of us will age. And that would be interesting to measure that in the past more formally, because we will learn which conditions led people to actually age faster. The problem is that, and actually Eric mentioned that earlier today, some clocks such as those ones exist. Typically, they use DNA methylation to find correlation with age, as I explained, for the chronological clock, but they throw in many more parameters that are measurements in the blood, in the liver, in living tissues, of the activities of those tissues, how inflammation looks like in those tissues. And when they do that, for example, here, they sort people according to six particular classes of these phenotypic ages that are inferred, and they can show that those classes, they sort of correlate with comorbidities. So they indeed measure the probability that some of us will age faster, will have more comorbidities than others. So really, they manage to do that in living people. But in the past, we don't have liver, we don't have blood, we don't have any of that. So I guess the prospects for truly clean biological clocks that we could biologically interpret is probably thinner. But when it comes to biological classes, and I will leave you two with those ideas, I believe that the prospects are very good, in fact. So imagine that we could derive fairly precise age pyramids in the past for males and females. Here I put a 5 years precision to not go really in a yearly precision. Maybe we could compare the change in those distribution as a function of the change of the environment during typically a global warming or a glacial maximum or something like that, to actually measure biologically the effect of those changing environments to the life of people of the past. We could do that in natural environmental shifts, or much less natural environmental shifts, such as those that we promoted by changing lifestyles, for example, becoming farmers at the beginning of the Neolithic, for example. We could also measure other kinds of environmental shifts, like those we produce when we decided to go industrial, right? So there's a large prospect. And the last one that I want to mention is that we could do that at the time of massive epidemics in the past, such as Black Death, for example, to really measure the impact, whether those pathogens killed every one of us or only a subset of us as a function of age. And with that, I would love to thank you again for the invitation and being present right now, but also my tons of collaborators here, specifically the work of a postdoc of mine, Xiexie Liu, as well as a former PhD of mine, Christian Henghui, and of course, my sponsors. Thank you so much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.